Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana, Cuba. First, a press review on the use of AI in warfare, notably in Iran, Ukraine, and Gaza. Then press reviews on Trump's threat to pull out of NATO and how that is unifying Europe. France 24 has a reporter in Tehran who gives a daily summary of airstrikes and damage to non-military targets. Then Scoop is a weekly talk show discussing media with host William Hildebrand. This week's show is an interview with renowned Israeli journalist Gideon Levy. He talks about media censorship in Israel and other countries, especially about war and self-censorship. France 24.
And it's time now to look at the press review. And Ilitsa Gadeva joins us. And Ilitsa, papers are discussing the use of AI in warfare. What have you found?
That's right, Oliver. Well, I want to start with this front page here by French left-wing paper Libération. And the headline here reads, AI war in automatic mode. And it's an analysis that says that today AI plays a very significant role in warfare, including in Iran, Ukraine, and in Gaza. And the article talks about the many different uses of AI. It gives many examples, including U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's AI-first approach. And it says that what has changed with AI is that there's no need for data analysts to analyze anymore the information that comes from satellites and video imagery, for example. This is all done by AI bots. So in practical terms, AI accelerates the kill chain, writes Libération. And the article also speaks about the cognitive gap between the person who launches the attack and the victim and how it desensitizes the attacker. And it also mentions a study by King's College in London that says that AI models appear to make decisions that lead to escalation way more quickly than when humans make the decisions. So, for example, they threaten to use nuclear weapons in nearly 95% of the simulated scenarios. And that's also the topic of this interview here by a French left-wing paper, Le Monde, that interviewed a philosopher who specializes in military ethics. And she says the use of lethal autonomous weapons controlled by AI goes against the principles of a just war. And she says that in order to ensure the proportionality of the strike, we actually need to take a step back. And data needs to be verified in advance by humans in order to carry out what has been dubbed effective human oversight.
Lots of reactions to Donald Trump's threat to pull the US out of the NATO alliance, Dixie.
Metro, the British Daily, for this headline today, star-spangled banner in the works, it says, referring to Donald Trump's threats to pull the US out of NATO. The British, another British Daily, the Independent, focusing on those comments as well, because Donald Trump also, he made those threats ahead of his televised speech to the American people on Wednesday night, in which he also vaunted about the successes of the war in Iran. The headline from the Independent here, Trump, I'll bomb Iran back into the Stone Age and I may quit NATO. So it sort of sums up what he's been saying. Lots of focus on Europe's response as well to these threats. This is from a website called the EU Observer, which notes here, fear but not panic in Europe after Donald Trump threatens to leave NATO, and Politico sort of also expands on this. Trump's rage at NATO allies is actually binding them together. It takes us behind the scenes of EU meetings being held recently, basically where they're trying to figure out solutions for a post-NATO sort of world. Politico reporting that EU leaders are not waiting for Donald Trump to follow up on his threats. As one official notes, NATO is already falling apart and leaders will not wait for it to be dead completely. So they're looking for more inward solutions, for instance, pumping more money into national defense budgets. Politico also says what's really remarkable about the war in Iran is how united EU leaders have been in refusing to help the U.S.
We've had a quiet few hours relatively here in the capital, but during the overnight hours, more airstrikes targeting Tehran and other cities in Iran. And now it's every day where we are reporting airstrikes hitting non-military targets. Overnight, airstrikes targeted two of Iran's steel factories, including one of Iran's biggest in Isfahan. This is the second time in 5 days U.S. and Israeli forces have bombed Iran's steel factories. Iran is the leading steel manufacturer in the region. So these are bombings that are going to impact the many, many Iranians who work for this industry. Tehran says this is a clear sign that U.S. and Israeli forces are intentionally targeting Iran's economic infrastructure and committing war crimes. This war is now in its fifth week, and officials here say during that time, more than 100,000 non-military targets have been hit or damaged. Yesterday, state media reported an airstrike hitting one of Iran's leading pharmaceutical manufacturing companies. U.S. and Israeli airstrikes have hit universities, fuel storage depots, sports facilities, historical and cultural sites. Iran has responded by targeting industrial hubs in the region, including factories in Bahrain, the Emirates, and Israel. They also keep hitting U.S. bases and assets in the region with missiles and drones. Their message is, whatever target you hit here, we're going to do the same where you are.
We can cross to Tel Aviv and speak to award-winning journalist Guidon Levy. Hello to you, Guidon. First of all, just want to ask you, in one of your recent pieces, you called the media soldiers of the IDF. What made you say that?
The problem, William, of this media in Israel is not so much the military censorship, and we may talk about it. The main problem of Israeli media is the self-censorship, which is much more dangerous and much more destructive. The media by itself chooses now for many years, but especially in the war of Gaza, not to show the Israelis what they think the Israelis don't want to see. And we got now 2.5 years of such a poor coverage of the war in Gaza that anyone in any village in France saw more of Gaza than any Israeli in Tel Aviv. This was not made by the military censorship. This was the commercial choice of my colleagues, of the Israeli media, choosing for commercial reasons, not an ideological one, not to bother the viewers too much with unpleasant pictures. Now we are facing the war in Iran, and that's a little bit different. Now it's really military censorship. By the way, the only Western democratic country with censorship at all. The enemy of the freedom of speech in Israel are the media outlets by themselves. This is really ignorance of journalists who don't even start to understand what is the role of a journalist, including in times of war. Your role is never to serve the government or the army or anyone else. You should serve the viewers and you should save the truth. But we can't speak about censorship without mentioning the fact that Israel prevented of any Western journalists to get into Gaza for 2.5 years now. This is another shameful thing which cannot be ignored. Both Israeli journalists and Western journalists, it's maybe the only war in history which is totally not covered.
Yeah, and nearly 300 journalists were killed amid that war in Gaza between 2023-2025, at least in the wider region.
Not only in the war in Gaza, you didn't see Gaza, but in this war, you will not hear any critical views about the war in Israeli media, in the mainstream media. a lot of critics about Netanyahu, about the government, about politics, about economy, nothing about the war. And then you get this North Korean figure of 93% of the Jewish Israelis who support this war. Can you believe it? 93%. Give me one example of any issue which gets such a majority in a democracy. No doubts, no question marks. Following this war, justified or not, clever or not, we stand behind it.
Gidon, thank you so much for your time. Gidon Levy, award-winning Israeli journalist.
Those reports and excerpted interview were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. Also, most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. I highly recommend listening to the entire interview with Gidon Levy, available online with the title Israel Tightens Media Restrictions. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Deutsche Welle's Sarah Kelly talks with Misha Komodowski about Trump's claim that the new president of Iran asked him for a ceasefire. She also speaks with Fawaz Girgis about Trump's claims and the new situation where Iran controls shipping in the Strait of Hormuz. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
U.S. President Donald Trump is claiming that Iran's new president has asked for a ceasefire. In a post on his Truth Social website, Trump said that Iran's new regime president, much less radicalized and far more intelligent than his predecessors, has just asked the United States of America for a ceasefire. We will consider when the Hormuz Strait is open, free, and clear. Until then, we are blasting Iran into oblivion, or as they say, back to the Stone Ages. Now, Iran's foreign ministry has described Trump's claims as false and baseless. Iran also has no new president, but the same one as before the war. I'm joined now by our correspondent, Misha Komodowski, in Washington, D.C. And Misha, what evidence did Trump present that Iran would like to come to a ceasefire?
Well, Sarah, President Trump did not really present any verifiable evidence here. He relied on his own claims of back-channel communication, which has not been confirmed by Iran or by independent sources. As supporting evidence, he pointed to his assertion that Iran's new leadership was more open to negotiations. He pointed to claims of private or indirect outreach from Tehran.
Misha, Iran has denied any direct talks with the United States, but who's speaking for the country?
Well, this denial doesn't necessarily mean that no context exists. It means no officially acknowledged negotiations exist. And officially, the message comes from Iran's foreign ministry, which handles public diplomacy, public messaging, and is the voice we hear denying those negotiations. But analysts say that the real power in Iran sits much higher, with the supreme leader and a network of security institutions, including the Revolutionary Guard. And those actors don't usually speak publicly, and they have a history of using back channels or intermediaries here. So when Trump claims that Iran is signaling interest in a ceasefire and Tehran publicly denies it, as we see here, both things can be actually true at the same time.
And let's get more on all of this. I'd like to bring in Fawaz Girgis. He is professor of Middle Eastern politics and international relations at London School of Economics in London. I'd just like to begin by asking you who you think is currently speaking on behalf of Iran. Are there competing centers of power?
Well, we know what we know in the past 4 weeks or so is that Israel and the United States have assassinated most of the top leaders of Iran, including the supreme leader, the defense minister, the de facto leader of Iran, Ali Larijani. Now you still have Mujtaba Khamenei, who was selected as a new supreme leader, even though we have not really seen him publicly. You have the president of Iran, you have the head of the parliament, Ghalibaf. Keep in mind for your own viewers that basically Israel and the United States are hunting Iran's leaders on an hourly basis. So if you were in Iran, how can you really sit and deliberate and consult and strategize? So you don't really, we no longer have a centralized decision-making process. What you have is a fragmented decision-making process. So the president, the head of the parliament, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, and that's why it seems to me it's going to be very, very difficult to reach any kind of a enduring ceasefire or settlement between the United States and Iran, given that the war itself in Iran is hunting and really traumatizing Iran leaders, in particular political leaders, as opposed to the Islamic Revolutionary Guards who are operating the war.
If you had to guess, and if you were to put this conflict into the bigger picture for us, when all is said and done, where do you think this fighting might leave Iran and where it might leave the region?
Well, you know, as we say, we teach our students that basically you can easily start a war, but you'll never end the war on your own terms. And political actions, particularly wars, do sometimes really produce the opposite results from the intended consequences. If you ask me about the big picture now, it seems to me that while the United States and Israel have achieved some major tactical gains, destroying, I mean, Iran's industrial base and strategic infrastructure and killing its top leaders, they have really lost the war strategically. That Iran, think of what Iran has done just by surviving, by resisting. It has now asserted control over the Strait of Hormuz the first time in more than 50 years. It still controls more than 400 kilos of enriched uranium. It has increased the economic pain worldwide. You in Germany and here I am in the United Kingdom and the United States and all over the world. And the reality is now, I mean, unless there is a diplomatic solution, unless there is a peaceful solution between the United States and Iran, Iran will end up controlling the Strait of Hormuz. And this will be the first time ever. And basically controlling the flow of more than 27%, between 20 and 27% of oil and gas, and a third of fertilizers goes through the Strait of Hormuz on a daily basis. In fact, economists estimate that Iran could make up to $80 billion annually if they impose a toll in the Strait of Hormuz. So here you have it. The reality is no one knows what's going to happen, because remember, this is a moving target. You and I were talking about a moving target. Things are changing. I mean, who knows? If the war continues, President Trump and Israel could destroy Iran, period. Destroy its regime, destroy, deindustrialize Iran, and as President Trump says, take it back to the Stone Age.
Favaz Djerjes, professor of Middle Eastern politics and international relations at London School of Economics.
That excerpt and analysis was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. That entire interview, entitled Iran Denies Trump's Claim, is available online and highly recommended. Deutsche Welle is also available at most podcast sites. Next, NHK Japan. Japan and the European Union have agreed to strengthen cooperation in security and defense industries. The Japanese Defense Ministry is deploying extended-range missiles to its camps, a major shift in security policy. NHK Japan.
Japan and the European Union have agreed to further strengthen cooperation and dialogue in a wide range of areas related to security and defense. Japan's Foreign Minister Motegi Toshimitsu and EU Foreign Policy Chief Kaja Kallas talked for over one hour, in France on Thursday on the sidelines of a G7 foreign ministerial meeting.
In this very difficult geopolitical environment, our cooperation is increasingly more important.
In addition to economic and trade, I hope to take the relationship to new highs in the fields of politics and security.
Motegi conveyed Japan's intention to deepen strategic coordination with the EU and its member countries. Areas include the defense industry and strengthening supply chains, particularly those for critical minerals. Motegi and Kallas also discussed the situation in the Indo-Pacific region. They focused on how to respond to North Korea, as well as Russia's invasion of Ukraine. They also exchanged views on the conditions in the Middle East and agreed to continue close cooperation.
Japan's defense ministry is deploying extended-range missiles to ground self-defense force camps as part of the country's counter-strike capabilities. The move represents a major shift in security policy. The deployment of two types of extended-range missiles began on Tuesday. Camp Kengun in Kumamoto Prefecture is receiving upgraded Type 12 surface-to-ship missiles with a range of about 1,000 kilometers. And Camp Fuji in Shizuoka Prefecture is being equipped with hyper-velocity gliding projectiles, or HVGPs. These have a range of several hundred kilometers and are designed to strike invading forces on remote islands from the ground at long distances. Japan's possession of counter-strike capabilities is outlined in the National Security Strategy, which was approved by the government in 2022. Defense Ministry sources say U.S. military intelligence will be essential for using missiles against remote targets.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're now heard at 10 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. NHK may also be easily found at most podcast sites. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this show, my PayPal contact information is available at my website, outfarpress.com, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. I'm truly grateful for all the donations. They're essential for the weekly production and website fees for this show, which I supply freely to more than 100 radio stations around the world. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. On Tuesday, a Russian oil tanker began unloading 100,000 tons of crude oil despite the threats from the U.S., Mexican President Sheinbaum said that her country is working to resume oil shipments to Cuba. She also disclosed that she personally donated $1,000 in a campaign to purchase resources for the Cuban people. An Israeli airstrike targeted a clearly marked press car in Lebanon, killing all three journalists on board. An estimated 8 million people participated in last Saturday's No Kings protest, the largest single day of protest in U.S. history. Radio Havana, Cuba.
On Tuesday, a Russian oil tanker, the Anatoly Kologin, docked at the port of Matanzas, located to the east of Havana, the capital, and began unloading more than 100,000 tons of crude oil. Yesterday, the Cuban Foreign Ministry thanked the people and government of Russia for their solidarity, demonstrated by the arrival of the Russian oil tanker to the island. According to a statement by the Foreign Ministry of Cuba, this valuable aid arrives amid the energy blockade imposed by the United States, which is attempting to suffocate the Cuban people. The statement also echoed the words of Dmitry Peskov, spokesperson for the Russian president, who expressed that it is Russia's duty not to remain on the sidelines and to provide the necessary assistance to the Cuban people. Russia has vowed to continue sending oil shipments to Cuba, and Mexico has also vowed to begin once again sending oil to the Cuban island. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum reaffirmed that her country is working to reactivate oil shipments to Cuba amid the tightening of the U.S. embargo and the blockade against the Caribbean nation. During her regular press conference at the National Palace in Mexico City, Sheinbaum clarified, "Humanitarian aid is one thing, trade agreements we have with Cuba are another, and that also involves oil shipments. The Mexican president added that these trade agreements have been in place for decades. This isn't something new, and that joint work with the Cuban government continues on both issues. Mexican president announced that she personally donated 20,000 pesos, approximately $1,104, to a fundraising campaign published in the newspaper La Jornada, supported by former President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, to collect resources and purchase them for the island. This initiative complements the shipment of various products by the Mexican government. The situation of the U.S. blockade against Cuba and the alternative energy supply options continue to be monitored in the region, while Mexico maintains its cooperative stance based on respect for sovereignty and the framework of international law. An Israeli strike targeted a marked press car in southern Lebanon over the weekend, killing Ali Shoaib of Manar TV, Al Manar, reporter Fatima Fetouni of Al Mayadeen TV, and her brother, freelance cameraman Mohammed Eftouni. Israel's military said it had targeted Shoaib, accusing him of being a Hezbollah intelligence operative without providing any evidence whatsoever, because there is no evidence. Israel made no mention of the other two journalists who were killed. Another journalist, a friend and companion of those killed, had this to say: "The important thing we all want to draw attention to is that the Israeli enemy, once they find anyone standing for rights and supporting the oppressed, tries to silence that voice. And the voice of the oppressed cannot be stopped, despite the enemy trying to overpower it, no matter how many killings they carry out." Lebanon's information minister said the Lebanese government would file a complaint with the UN Security Council over what he called Israel's deliberate and blatant war crime against the media in killing the three journalists. An estimated 8 million people took the streets of cities across 50 U.S. states over the weekend, and more than one dozen countries around the world. Thousands, tens of thousands, millions in protests against U.S. President Donald Trump under the banner No Kings. Organizers say it was the largest single day of protests in U.S. history. In St. Paul, Minnesota, around 200,000 protesters gathered at the state capitol, just miles from where federal immigration agents fatally shot Renee Good and Alex Pretty in January.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at 6000. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Time. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for the show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. Please consider subscribing. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The shortwave report remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. This month, the shortwave report is celebrating having been on the air for 30 years without a break. If you appreciate this weekly program, please help support it. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.